nice treat? Don't hesitate to make a date to visit Old Farm Fine Foods. Pizza, frittata, sausage rolls, sandwiches, soups, and more are ready and waiting to get in your belly. Plus, you can also buy fresh and frozen food to prepare at home. Pop into the shop Monday through Sunday between 8 to 6 at 204 Berry Street. And don't forget to follow Old Farm Fine Foods on Instagram at Old Farm FF to get the scoop on the latest goodies. Old Farm Fine Foods, comfort food you can count on.
Short set of stairs, join me, Grim, in the basement for my working knowledge of indie, experimental, post-punk, and electronic, every Wednesday from 10 until 11 p.m. on CFRC 101.9 FM. Get ready to press record.
It is 11 a.m. on Friday, September 5th, and you're tuned in to CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Christina Laurie, and this is Kingston Currents. CFRC's news programming is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. In today's episode, we'll be chatting with a local artist making it big with his first worldwide release, a few exciting updates from Kingston Health Sciences Center, and we'll step into the great outdoors with a local nature therapy guide. Kingston local artist Colton Fox is celebrating a milestone this week, the worldwide release of Witch Hazel, the award-winning comic series he co-creates with artist Beige Bloom. The series follows Hazel, a young witch in Toronto who takes on supernatural odd jobs. 3 years since its first release, Witch Hazel is reaching audiences far beyond Kingston, with its first global release through publisher Silver Sprocket. Fox dropped by CFRC to talk about his journey from getting started to international distribution.
I've always been into comics, like as an art medium. I always felt it was like the best of both worlds, like words and pictures. You know, it's like, what's better than that? The experience of kind of like creating almost like this movie in your head while looking at these still images that like pack so much life in it that they don't feel like still images at all. And so I got really into those. And then my first kind of published work was when I was at Humber College. I was the like editorial like newspaper artist. So I would do like two comics a week in their paper. And then from there, I got involved into like anthologies in Toronto and then eventually into self-publishing my own works. And then now seeing them professionally published is a huge reward.
After spending time in Toronto, Fox returned to Kingston during the pandemic and found his place in the local art scene.
Kingston was a great place for me. In Toronto, there's a lot of competition in terms of like being a comic artist and just an artist in general. Whereas Kingston, I found it was a lot more accommodating for me, and there was a lot of interest in the work that I was creating. So like the Skeleton Press, they were great, like offering me a lot of full page comics and doing local stories, ones that I got a lot of fun, like researching the topics that they were giving me. And that made me a lot closer to the Kingston scene. And then I had a residency at the Tent Setter, through Modern Fuel, like this artist run community. So they were fantastic. I really appreciated that opportunity to explore my artwork even further. And then the Isabel Bader Center for the Performing Arts also commissioned me for a series of illustrations for a theatrical project that they did. So shout out Kingston, like they've been such wonderful supporters of my work.
And it was during Fox's time in Kingston that Witch Hazel bloomed.
I was also involved in a anthology called Horny for Charity, where it was a bunch of artists doing sexy drawings to benefit charities that were kind of struggling during the pandemic, such as the 519. And so in that anthology, I came across Beige's artwork and I really loved it. I love that they could do kind of like a realistic figure, but then also like a cartoony figure. And that range in style was really awesome to see. So I reached out to her and I was like, hey, like, I really want to collaborate with other artists. Like, typically, like, I was more of an artist than a writer. But then whenever I was working with the writers, I would have a lot of notes and they were getting fed up with me. And they're like, well, if you think you know how to write, why don't you write the damn thing? And I was like, maybe I will. And then here we are. So I wrote the story and then I did like the page breakdowns, like the layouts for the story, so that Beige could focus on just doing the artwork. And I asked if that was okay. And they were like, totally. So from there, I asked her, like, you know, what are your interests? Like music, movies, like let's curate a vibe so that you'll enjoy drawing and I'll enjoy writing and we can like marry our ideas. And so Witch Hazel came from that. So there's a lot of like autobiographical elements in Witch Hazel. So like the summary is that she's a witch who does odd jobs on a supernatural job app. And so that was pulled from me. You know, the when you're an artist, you get a lot of weird gigs and a lot of odd jobs. But I also did door to door for a community action group to get people to sign petitions. And so it was a lot of like knocking on strangers' doors. But that like experience was very much in Witch Hazel, where she, you know, goes door to door and goes into these other these strangers' apartments to solve like these conflicts with magic. And fun fact, I didn't know that Witch Hazel was a plant at the time. I just was like, Hazel's a nice name for a witch. And then I saw like, this bottle of lotion that says Witch Hazel. I was like, what the? They stole my idea.
That's so I thought that had to be an intentional.
I know it was complete after the fact. I thought like I was originally going to name the book like Witchcraft or something. But then when I found out that Witch Hazel is a thing, I was like, oh my God, that's like perfect. So I made that the title.
The response to the first issue, released in 2022, made it clear that Fox and Bloom had conjured something special.
And so that first issue was entirely self-published, and it went on to be voted Best Independent Canadian Comic of 2022. So that was really exciting. And shout out Kingston, because it was from popular vote. So a lot of people in Kingston showed up and voted for it, and we had flyers and business windows and stuff. And they said that that was the most votes they've ever gotten, which was really exciting to see. And so we got like a little plaque, which was really cute.
The local support came in many forms, with grants like ones from Awesome Foundation Kingston helping Witch Hazel along the way.
I should also mention that the Awesome Foundation in Kingston also gave us a $1,000 grant. It was really funny. I didn't really know what to expect when I applied for it, but I wasn't expecting to like stand in downtown Kingston, like in that center where like they have the farmer's market. I had to like stand down there and then loudly like in public, like pitch Witch Hazel to like strangers. And I don't think that was properly explained to me ahead of time. So it was so scary. But I had also come up with a magic trick ahead of time, which I think got me the grant. Like I learned how to like, I don't want to spoil how the trick is done, but basically like you light the end of a stick on fire, and then through sleight of hand, you turn it into a flower. And I think that magic trick got me $1,000 because like that had to have been the reason I won, because there were many other wonderful people looking for that grant as well. But so shout out Awesome Foundation, another example of Kingston being awesome and being super supportive of the arts.
However, as the audience continued to grow, getting the comic into readers' hands was no small feat.
With the previous issues, how distribution worked was I had to call up comic book shops. I had to, you know, bring them in a backpack or mail them off. And it's like really time consuming. It's really expensive as well. Like sometimes you might not even make any money after, you know, if you have to spend like $60 shipping books and then they take their cut, you're only making like, you know, $40. So it's like, woo, awesome. I can buy like a coffee, you know?
But that changed when Witch Hazel was picked up by Silver Sprocket, an indie publisher with international reach. Now readers across the globe can find the comic at their local shop and large retailers.
So with Silver Sprocket being able to distribute the book around the world, like I was able to call up stores across Canada. I was able to message people in comic groups that are in Australia, the Netherlands, like Europe, and they were able to get the comic in stores there. And it, like, I was getting a bit of an international audience, even of people being in like, you know, England and being like, oh, I want one of your comics. Like, how do I get it? And I was just like, that's the neat part. You can't. But now because of Silver Sprocket, it's I can say, oh, just go to your local comic shop and they can get it.
And Fox and Bloom have no plans of stopping anytime soon.
With the Silver Sprocket release, it's you know, reaching so many more people, and so many more people are like, you know, from different parts of the world are saying how much they love it and like saying such kind things. And a bunch of people even said it was like the best comic of the week, you know, this little indie book that no one's ever heard of, best comic of the week, better than Batman. And I'm like, whoa, yeah, take that, Batman. So that was that meant a lot. Yeah, I'm just really excited to have, you know, like grown the audience, seen people's reactions to the comic and seeing how much it's meant to them. And, you know, like Hazel's like a queer woman of color, and like the artistic team, like Beige, is part of that demographic. And so, like, you know, it's getting kind of hairy out there for a lot of people from different communities. And, you know, that's, it's really heartbreaking to see. And so I'm happy that, like, I've been able to put this comic out there that is, you know, full of joy, like good messages, you know, magic, comedy, action, fantasy, romance, like just like having this like fun comic out there. You know, just trying to make the world a little bit of a better place through it and through the artwork and through the storytelling, like having that, having the larger reach to make, you know, a bit of a difference, however small that might be, like that really brings me a lot of joy. And really fuels my passion to keep making more, because we have so many more Witch Hazel stories. It's, you know, there's so many written and so many in the backlog that, you know, we really just are excited to have the means to produce more and to share more instead of having to wait for me to save up enough paychecks to get the next issue out.
Once again, that was Colton Fox, local artist and co-creator of Witch Hazel. He and co-creator Beige Bloom are celebrating the comic's worldwide release with signings across Ontario, and you can catch them tonight, Friday, September 5th, at Kingston Nexus on Bagot Street from 5 to 8 p.m. A $1 million fundraising pledge from the annual Rose of Hope Ladies Golf Tournament has made it possible to fund a new clinical chair position at Kingston Health Sciences Center. After raising $3.5 million over its 27-year history in support of women's health at KHSC, this year's tournament set its sights on a new, ambitious goal: establishing the Rose of Hope Clinical Chair in Breast Health at Kingston Health Sciences Center. KHSC has announced that Dr. Doris Jabs will be taking on this new leadership role. A women's imaging radiologist with more than two decades of experience, Dr. Jabs is also the longtime regional breast imaging lead for the Ontario Breast Screening Program and one of the driving forces behind the creation of KHSC's Breast Imaging Kingston, BIC, a state-of-the-art breast cancer screening and diagnostic facility. Dr. Jabs sat down with CFRC to share what this appointment means for her and the future of breast health in Kingston.
So the Rose of Hope Clinical Chair in Breast Health is truly, it's an inaugural position, and it really is an honor for me to be in this role. I've been in Kingston as a breast radiologist for, I don't want to give away my age, but I'm moving on to my end of my second decade, and breast imaging truly is a passion for me. I enjoy every day going to work. I enjoy my work. I enjoy the people I work with, and I enjoy the people that I am providing a service to. This position is very special. So this position moves us from the excellent technology that we have, the amazing facility at Breast Imaging Kingston, which if you haven't been to, you really should at least zip by to see how special it is, to a more transformative position, which is now going to bring all that technology together with the expertise that we have in the city, which is excellent across multiple disciplines. So we have expertise in primary care, family physicians, in imaging, breast radiology, oncology, surgery, pathology. And this position now is going to marry all that together, or attempt to marry all that together, and find gaps that we can close in innovative ways, thinking out of the box, in a real patient-centered or client-centered approach. So this is going to be all about the women, the people that we serve. It's going to be about making their journey quicker, simpler, hopefully less anxiety-laden together.
According to KHSC, unlike funding for a single piece of equipment, a clinical chair position provides the time and resources for a physician to drive innovation in care, research, and education. Dr. Jabs explained the transformative power of a clinical chair role and some of her goals walking into the position.
So a clinical chair, I believe the other position that we have is in genomics. The clinical chair is very different. So the way the system currently works is we have all these specialties that do have heads of department and heads of sections, and they're all excellent in and of their own right. There's the surgeons are excellent, the pathologists are excellent, the radiologists, the primary care. They're all very good, but it's a bit siloed. From a patient perspective, in any case, I think it's a bit siloed. And so although everybody is doing excellent work in their area, you need somebody or something or a role to be able to tie that all together, right, for the people that experience the care. So we as care providers are excellent care providers in our area, but the people that we care for actually move within all those different areas. And so it's to bring all of that together. And that is a very unique role that we currently have at KGH. It is very forward thinking. I'm very excited to be in this position.
And what kinds of innovation are you looking to explore? What are you excited about?
Can't give away all of my secrets, of course, right? it's going to be iterative. So I certainly have some ideas already that we're rolling out that we're going to try and bring sort of some that we can do very quickly, others that will take a little bit longer. I think one of the most important things is I'm really keen on getting a rapid access type service going at the BIC. So this can be done in many different ways, but basically it's a way to have women be seen quicker in a seamless way. We definitely are going to be updating ourselves and bringing in all the new technologies that we have. We have AI platforms, we have digital technologies, we have social media, we have all these innovative technological tools available that I think have been perhaps maybe a little bit underused. So I'm certainly going to try and bring some of those in. We have to reach out to our underserved communities. That is a definite gap that we need to address. And so those are sort of some of our initial initiatives.
Yeah. And I mean, you kind of dove into this right there, but I was wondering if you could speak to some of the challenges that we're facing in breast health and those first things that you're really wanting to address when you walk into this position.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is just my personal experience and what I've gleaned over my years of working in the field. I think some of the barriers that we have in breast health is there's some fear around it. Certainly there are some groups that are very keen on getting screened and keen on their breast health. There are others that don't know. So education is a huge gap that we need to fill. People may just not know about what they need to do for their breast health. And then there are others, I think, that are anxious and have fears which may have a foundation, fears which may not be grounded. And so I think those are all barriers to getting screened, to being an advocate for your breast health, to getting things done. And so we need to really increase our screen participation rate in the region. That's the key thing in breast health, right? It's all about breast screening. It's all about detection. And the OBSP, the Ontario Breast Screening Program, which is our provincial breast screening program, has recently dropped the age of screen. So historically, women from the age of 50 to 72 were invited to the breast screening program, and we've now dropped that to 40. So I think there's a huge group of people out there that we could now access that may or may not even know that this is what's available for them. So it's sort of trying to take away the fear a little bit, to decrease the anxiety through education and absolutely through accessibility.
This year's Rose of Hope tournament raised $285,000, the first installment of their five-year pledge.
The Rose of Hope is very special. They are a very energizing and inspiring group of women. Although I've been aware of the Rose of Hope and we've had them support multiple technologies at the BIC, our MRI is coming online early 2026. They were fundamental in other technologies at the BIC to include our prone biopsy table and prone biopsy device. So they're not new to me. I'm not new to them. But the Rose of Hope tournament this year, which was all about this clinical chair position and their fundraising for that, was truly humbling, inspiring, energizing, all at the same time. These women are a very dedicated group of women to truly improve the care that the women in our region are receiving. It's fantastic.
Kingston Health Sciences Center is officially the first hospital in Canada to implement a groundbreaking artificial intelligence tool used to diagnose coronary artery disease. Coronary artery disease is the most common form of cardiovascular disease and the leading cause of death worldwide. It occurs when the coronary arteries become narrowed or blocked, reducing blood flow to the heart. Thanks to a $100,000 donation from local donor Steven Sorensen, KHSC has introduced HeartFlow, a revolutionary AI-based technology that's transforming cardiac care. HeartFlow enables radiologists and cardiologists to measure blood flow through a patient's coronary arteries using a non-invasive CT scan. Dr. Omar Islam, head of diagnostic radiology at KHSC, explained what the diagnostic process for coronary artery disease has looked like until now.
Patients with stable chest pain typically undergo a CT scan of their heart to look at the coronary arteries, which are the blood vessels that supply oxygen and glucose to the heart muscle. And a narrowing of those blood vessels, especially severe narrowing of those blood vessels, can be significant and may be a precursor to that patient having a heart attack in the future. So those patients are typically triaged by a coronary CT angiogram to look at those blood vessels, and it's a dye that's injected into the veins, and we get a 3D map of the blood vessels. So that's how it's done. And then those patients, if they have severe narrowing on the coronary CTA, are referred potentially on to the cath lab, so the angio suite, so undergo a minor surgical procedure where that narrowing is confirmed. And if the narrowing is confirmed, then a blood flow analysis is performed, looking at the reduction in blood flow through those vessels. And reduction in blood flow is actually the most important determinant of the risk of having a heart attack. So if the blood flow is reduced, that means there's reduced delivery of oxygen and glucose to the heart muscle, and then that patient is at risk for a heart attack. So it's not really the narrowing that's most important, it's the reduction in blood flow. So we cannot assess in a typical situation the blood flow on CT. We can only assess the narrowing of the blood vessel. And so those patients typically have to be sent to the cath lab for the minor surgical procedure to look at blood flow.
Now, using the AI capabilities of HeartFlow, physicians can measure blood flow directly from a CT scan. If the flow is normal, the patient avoids an invasive procedure entirely.
Yeah, so HeartFlow is a really cool new technology. So it's a non-invasive technology that uses those CT scan images and it extrapolates blood flow from the narrowing in those blood vessels. So in essence, it gives the doctor the same information that they would otherwise need to get from the cath lab doing that minor surgical procedure. And now we get that information non-invasively from the CT scan images themselves. So it really is a one-stop shop for assessment of the coronary arteries and risk of heart disease and strokes.
For patients, this means faster answers and better care with less risk.
It's beneficial for the patients in many ways. First of all, it's non-invasive. So a cath lab is a minor surgical procedure, and patients have to come into the hospital for day surgery, and they have to have a puncture in their groin vessels or in their arm vessels, and they have to have dye and have pictures of their heart taken under radiation. And so, these procedures are performed every day throughout the country. They're extremely safe, but there's still a very small risk of complications such as bleeding or stroke. And of course, no one wants to undergo an invasive procedure if they don't have to. So in, up to 30% of patients, heart flow analysis avoids that patient from having to undergo that invasive angio procedure. Also, because the heart flow is applied when the patient has their CAT scan, they get the answer, the diagnosis, within a few minutes to a few hours, rather than having to wait weeks or days for the catheter procedure to occur. So they get an answer immediately. And because they get that answer right away, they can potentially get started on treatment and medications right after their CT scan with heart flow, rather than having to wait until after the results of the cath lab. Furthermore, there's less, obviously, radiation and contrast dye exposure because they're only getting a CT scan. They're not getting an angio procedure in the cath lab, so they avoid radiation and contrast dye. This is especially useful in some elderly patients or other patients who have diabetes and kidney disease, where the risk of kidney malfunction is higher with repeated contrast dye exposure. So in those patients, this test is very useful because we don't have to give the patients contrast dye twice.
This technology is also a game changer for healthcare providers and the healthcare system.
This is really, really an amazing tool from the healthcare efficiency perspective. The fact that the heart flow triages the right patients to go onwards to cath lab is really important because it reduces hospital admissions and procedure backlogs in the cath lab. We have long wait lists everywhere in our healthcare system. So by triaging the right patient to undergo the right test, this saves time and, of course, avoids patients from having to undergo these unnecessary procedures. Therefore, the time in the cath lab can be directed to patients who actually need to be there. It's also leads to better outcomes because of timely treatment for those who need it. And for those who don't need the procedure, heart flow provides the reassurance that their blood flow is not reduced and is not significant, and therefore they don't need to go on to further testing.
HeartFlow is now fully operational at KHSC.
So far, so good. We plan on collecting data from all the patients who undergo cardiac CT and HeartFlow analysis. We expect approximately 100 patients over the next 12 months to undergo the HeartFlow analysis. So we'll have a lot more information, coming up in the next year.
Teams at KHSC will be studying the technology's effectiveness in Canadian patients, with the goal of publishing their findings and inspiring adoption in hospitals across the country.
This technology, although it is new, it is a game changer. It works. It's been validated across multiple centers in the United States and Europe. We are fortunate to be the first site in Canada, all of Canada, to be using it. But we do hope that, our use provides recognition and is newsworthy enough so that government officials, including Ministry of Health in Ontario, take notice and realize the value in, not just for individual patients, but for the healthcare system in implementation of this technology broadly across all sites in Ontario. We do feel that there's a big role for artificial intelligence in the healthcare system to work alongside the physicians, the administrators, and the staff to increase efficiencies, provide more accurate diagnosis, faster diagnosis, and improve the quality of care. We see AI as a tool that augments the care that we can provide to our patients.
Before we get into more local news, I'm going to turn to Jesse Bell with your CFRC weather and traffic report for this weekend.
This is your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Friday, we get the remnants of that Thursday rainy day with a daytime high of 18 degrees. A couple of rain clouds here and there, but largely it's going to be a beautiful day here in the city of Kingston, just in time for the Queens game against the Laurier Golden Hawks under the lights at Richardson Stadium. Moving into the first weekend of September, Saturday, September 6th, daytime high of 17 with about a 50% chance of rain, and Sunday, September 7th, 17 degrees as well, but with lots of bright sunshine. And then moving into the start of next week, Monday, September 8th, 17 degrees and sunny. This is Jesse Bell with your City of Kingston traffic report. We begin with road closures. Aberdeen Street, William 2 Johnson is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging. Albert Street, Princess to Mac, closed to accommodate construction activity and staging at 484 Albert Street. Berry Street, Queen to Colborne, closed for construction-related activity at 283 Queen Street. Cranbrook Street, Lakeview to Days, is closed on school days from 8:40 a.m. to 9:20 a.m. and 3:20 p.m. to 3:50 p.m. for a school street at Our Lady of Lourdes Catholic School. DeMare Avenue, Taylor Kidd to Wheat Hill, is closed September 2nd from 7 a.m. to 5 p.m. for a paving operation. Earl Street, Collingwood to Toronto, is closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. King Street, the tragically hip way to Place d'Armes, is closed September 4th from 4 to 7:30 p.m. for the Kingston Frontenac's annual season ticket holder barbecue. Kings Court Avenue, concession to First, is closed September 2nd to October 10th for a gas main installation. Lincoln Drive at Bay Ridge, closed until September 19th for the construction of new active transportation infrastructure. Sydenham Street, Princess to Queen, closed until October 3rd for the Sydenham Street community space. Victoria Street, Union to Johnson, closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. Wheat Hill Street, DeMare to Gerald Hunt Memorial Park, closed September 2nd from 7 a.m. to 5 p.m. for a paving operation. And Woodburn Road, Hitchcock to Whitechurch, is closed for a contractor to complete culvert relining. Here are some other delays to be aware of. Bay Ridge Drive, Milford to Henderson, expect delays for the construction of new active transportation infrastructure and intersection upgrades. Catwoods Drive, Centennial to Gardeners, expect delays for the construction of a new multi-use pathway. Front Road, San Beta Country Club, expect delays for the installation of sanitary and water main for Utilities Kingston. Traffic will be reduced to one lane in each direction. Gardeners Road at Centennial and Creekford, expect delays while a contractor completes intersection widening, traffic signal upgrades, and cycling and pedestrian improvements. Highway 2, Abbeydon to St. Lawrence, expect delays to complete enhanced flood protection of Abbeydon Road, Highway 2 and St. Lawrence Avenue. Highway 15, Kingston Mills to Middle, expect delays for a contractor to complete work on the Highway 15 CNR overhead construction. John Marks Avenue and Innovation Drive, expect delays while a contractor mobilizes to start work on John Marks Avenue, Innovation Drive, and Discovery Avenue. Work includes curb, sidewalk, asphalt milling, and repaving. Lancaster Drive, Limestone to Jasper, expect delays while a contractor completes construction of a new sidewalk and road improvements. Montreal Street at John Counter, expect delays for upgrades to the intersection, including new lighting, traffic signals, lanes, paving, and signage to improve safety and efficiency for all road users. And Victoria Street and Earl Street, expect delays while a contractor mobilizes the site to start work on the second phase of reconstruction of sewer, water main, sidewalks, and road.
Thank you, Jesse. Now back to more local news. Yet another controversial development came before council at their meeting on Tuesday night. This time, a high-rise at Kingston's waterfront containing luxury apartment units. 5 Lower Union Street, currently a vacant wharf next to the Great Lakes Museum and Historic Dry Dock, is the site proposed by developer Homestead Land Holdings. The 19-story mixed-use building laid out in the proposal would provide 118 units, with 225 bedrooms total. The journey to council approval has been long for this proposal, with discussions starting in 2019. Councillor Connie Glenn started the discussion, cautioning council against moving forward with the development. Her first key concern was the community response.
It was a very contentious build, and I think that one of the fundamental issues that was brought forward is the community felt a lack of consultation. And I know that there are going to be a lot of counters to that. However, unfortunately, this development took a long time to make its way through the system. So initial consultations took place before this council even came into being. It was under the previous council, and a lot of it took place virtually. So there were a number of individuals, I think, quite caught off guard by this and wanted the opportunity to speak against it. At the end of the day, when we're building a community, it's important that the community feels we're actually building with them. And this just didn't hit the mark in that way. They felt that it was being built despite them, despite their legitimate concerns, and despite the fact that they felt they had a different vision for our city. And ignoring the concerns and the vision of constituents who actually currently live and reside in this place, I think is fundamentally going to be problematic for us as we move forward. I know that we say we're listening, but sometimes I'm really concerned that we're not hearing them.
In addition to the consultation piece, she also expressed concern regarding what this could mean for the future of Kingston's waterfront.
I also think that we are challenged here with what we are doing along our waterfront. We're seeing multiple proposals for various things to go along the waterfront. And we've heard criticism from the community about putting more tall buildings right on the water, like other cities have done, only to regret them much later on because that space is no longer there for the community.
Glenn concluded, noting a criticism that has come up with many recent residential developments.
I asked some questions about the affordability of this, and the reality is that these are not going to be affordable units. They're going to be very expensive units on the water. So yes, we're in a housing crisis, but the housing crisis is one of affordability. So until we're building more affordable units, like the ones that we're looking at for Verona, I don't think that we're making the mark, and I don't think that this makes the mark.
However, Councillor Wendy Stephen represented a different perspective.
The property taxes that come from this new build will feed into our operating budget. And our operating budget is what we use to do things like supportive housing. And we just approved supportive housing, and we know it's going to be expensive, and we need that money over time. So I think the argument that this isn't affordable housing, I mean, yeah, it's not, that's true. But through those property taxes, that generation will allow us to create more. We also need housing of all kinds. We've been through this a million times. We are in a housing crisis. We are still short. This will help.
In addition to this point, she mentioned some of the positive features the development could bring to the waterfront.
It's not just private residential. It is that. But it's also got continuation of the waterfront trail, which wouldn't be possible unless this land was developed. And it's also adding in green space for the community at the waterfront. Like, this is a win.
Ultimately, the amendments required for the development to move forward passed with a vote of 10-3.
I think that once it is built, I think people are actually going to like it.
According to the Rochester Institute of Technology, more than 22 million pounds of plastic pollution end up in the Great Lakes every year, the very same lakes that provide drinking water for more than 40 million Canadians and Americans. This September, Kingston will be one of six Ontario communities taking part in the province's first ever Great Lakes Coastal Cleanup. The event is organized by the Great Lakes and St. Lawrence Cities Initiative, a coalition representing communities in the Great Lakes and St. Lawrence River region. The organization secured $85,000 in provincial funding to support the shoreline cleanups taking place in Thunder Bay, Chatham-Kent, Owen Sound, Collingwood, Coburg, and Kingston. On World Rivers Day, September 28th, volunteers across Ontario will gather with the goal of collecting up to 440 pounds of litter along beaches, parks, and waterfronts. Mayor Brian Patterson spoke with CFRC regarding Kingston's part in the project.
Yeah, I think it's actually a really exciting initiative. When I think about all the characteristics and all the things that make Kingston, Kingston, there's lots of things that I can think of, but one of, I think, the most important treasures that we have is our waterfront. And it's something that, people just are naturally drawn to our waterfront. There's so many amazing places to enjoy. We've invested a lot as a city in different places and public spaces where people can go and appreciate and enjoy the waterfront. And so I think that really this event is about, capturing our community's imagination and in terms of making sure with stewardship that we're taking care of that waterfront, we're preserving it, and making sure that it continues to be just an amazing part of our city.
Local organizations and businesses have been stepping up to ensure the day will be a success.
What's been exciting is the number of local partner organizations that are really kind of going to be on the ground doing the work, whether it's Sustainable Kingston. You have Ahoy Rentals that's making, basically offering free kayaks for people that want to go along the shoreline and help clean up. We've also got our amazing diving community. They're going to be doing some of the in-water cleanup. We've got Rotary. We've got a number of different organizations that are that have agreed and are happy to sign up. And so that is really inspiring, right? I mean, we have Swim Drink Fish, which is another great organization that's really big into stewardship of clean water. And so I think it really has hit a nerve with a lot of people and a lot of organizations. And so I think we're going to have a small army out there on September the 28th. It'll be exciting to see.
While the project is starting with one-time provincial funding, Patterson says the momentum could encourage more initiatives like this in the future.
I think anything is possible. I think given the momentum that we've seen, I think there's absolutely opportunities to continue to do events like this. And in the past, there have even been a number of local groups that have gone out and of their own initiative have done what they can to clean up the our shoreline and to do what they can to beautify our waterfront. So I think that given that goal, I think there's always going to be community level interest, whether it will be under this umbrella or maybe just something else. I mean, we'll see how things evolve. But I think that, you know, this is a really great opportunity. And obviously we've been granted some one-time funding from the province. So we want to take advantage and do as best we can. If there's interest in continued partnership in future years, of course, we're more than happy to explore that.
Residents can find more information on the initiative at glslcities.org.
You know, everyone in our community understands the importance of sustainability and environmental stewardship, doing what we can as a community. But this is one of those tangible things that I think, you know, you can really see the impact of right away. I've already been incredibly impressed by the response that we've gotten from the community on this. There's going to be lots of interest that's going to continue to grow and to build towards cleanup day on the 28th and, of September. And so I'm excited, you know, really get a chance that, you know, if this is important to you, you can make a real difference right here in Kingston.
This past summer in Kingston was one of the hottest and driest in recent memory. And projections from the city of Kingston suggest this will become our new normal. By 2050, Kingston is expected to see the number of days over 30 degrees jump from an average of 6 per year to 22, coincided by longer stretches of drought. And the number of days over 32 degrees is projected to rise from just over 1 per year to more than 8. For many, summers like this feel unsettling, another reminder of the climate crisis. A study by Unite for Change found that 3/4 of Ontarians are experiencing anxiety about climate change and its impacts. Claire Beach, a local nature therapy guide with 6 years of experience guiding hundreds of people, has noticed it in her clients.
What I hear the most from people is that, you know, there's a lot of talk about the fact that we've sort of pushed past the point of no return. So there's a greater sense of helplessness or hopelessness that people are experiencing, and it comes up every day. And I think what I'm hearing from people is almost a desire to detach from nature, that if they touch it, they're going to make it worse. And they know that that's not what they need. They know that that's not right, that that's not the solution.
Her response to this anxiety involves a practice called forest bathing. Forest bathing has roots in 1980s Japan as a public health response, with research suggesting that time spent in nature can do a great deal to alleviate stress. Today, it's being embraced around the world, including here in Kingston.
It gives me greater perspective. It gives me active hope. It helps ground me and put everything in perspective, not just physically grounding us when we take off our shoes in a minute, not just feeling the sunlight on our skin and the air in our hair. It's a sense of belonging. It's a sense of connection, of being in community with the greater world around us. That brings hope, like almost instantly. It brings a sense of comfort and belonging that we forget is accessible to us anywhere that we go. It could be a city park, could be a tree in our backyard. It's there. And the more that we revisit those places over and over again, the deeper that connection becomes. That's where we feel that connection and that support. And it's almost like free therapy. It really is. And so it's accessible to everyone. And that's the other piece that I love the most. So I would say when it comes to climate anxiety, being able to feel the resilience and the power of nature can help alleviate some of that stress and anxiety.
Through her business, The Wild Edge, Claire helps clients connect with nature using the practice of forest bathing and nature therapy techniques. In this era of climate emergency, for many, forest bathing offers a way to acknowledge both beauty and loss.
And so I think they're coming to me for an alternative. So what is the new balance? How can we connect? How can I feel okay with what's going on? So I think that's the main reason why people are reaching out, is that they've kind of hit a point where they are deeply feeling that helplessness.
With the help of guides like Claire, the practice is fairly simple. Slow down, notice what's around you, and connect. But on recent walks, including a walk I joined her for at the Lemoyne Point Conservation Area, the signs of a changing climate are impossible to miss.
you look back to where we just walked through, and we're walking on dead, brown, dry grass. There are dead trees on either side of us. Yes, we're looking out towards a lake, but what's that water level currently at? When I was here a few weeks ago, there would have been geese and ducklings and all sorts all over the water. They're not there now. They're moving off as well, finding cooler spaces to be. So it's pretty poignant today. Like, I'm feeling it just standing among these dead trees.
These mixed emotions surfaced when I spoke with participant Jennifer Dawson, who started incorporating the practice into her routine last summer.
So I was always aware of nature therapy, but never having to really apply it in my own life. And then I had occasion last summer where I was going through some challenges and I thought, you know what, now's the time to try it. And I honestly haven't gone back, meaning that I'm continually making it a part of my life. It's interesting. I used to be a corporate social responsibility executive many years ago, and a lot of the work I did was to weave environmentally friendly activities into the corporate world. And I was exceptionally passionate about it, and still am. I find that the challenges that, you know, our lives have become so busy and so hectic that taking those pauses and being able to be mindful and notice the changes that are actually happening within the moment and within our this current period of history, we don't often do that. So with forest bathing, I find that that's now been a consistent check-in of noticing what's around and the changes that are happening.
One of those check-ins came during our walk at Lemoyne Point, where she noticed just how different the landscape looked.
What I noticed in our walk was that the forest, the ground, the grass, which, you know, nostalgically is always green and squishy and moist, and it wasn't. And I took that time to lay in it and to feel it and to sort of put words or feelings to how the grass may be feeling. And what I was absorbing was, you know, it was a state of chaos for the grass. But that we're literally in it together. And as I lay there and I could feel the prickly, crunchy grass on my skin, I was soothing the grass pain, and we were in it together, and knowing that we would come up with a solution. I don't know what that is yet, though, but that I was feeling that pain that the grass, but knowing the grass is resilient, and knowing that rain will come and that things will change and things will continually evolve and change. It was a challenge to absorb the two very polar sounds. You know, there is this orchestra of birds and crickets and nature sounds, and then we had planes going over and other human noises, and I was really challenged to integrate those both. But I think in the end it became sort of a symphony of the two, and each took its turn, if you will.
For Jennifer, that tension became part of the lesson, meeting nature where she's at.
My expectation of nature is that it doesn't stay the same. It's me who needs to change. And so the practice is so beneficial to one's mental health and well-being that it's my responsibility to meet nature where it's at. And if that's a messy, rainy day, so be it. That's beautiful and magical in its own way. Or if it's a crunchy, cold winter day, that's also nature's way of saying, hey, here's how I'm showing up today. Look at me. And so you just meet nature where she's at. You know, we do know that change is inevitable, and it might be within our own personal lives or it might be environmental, but it will continually evolve. And if we can play a positive part in our small, teeny tiny little part, then I think we've done our job.
Another participant, Jackie Wright, seconded this sentiment, adding how it connects to her climate activism.
I find that more of the doubt and the fear comes when I am sitting inside thinking about it from a different perspective rather than, yeah, just fully kind of submersing myself and experiencing it for all the beauty that is still here. I also believe that we are more creative, more powerful, more impactful when we are coming from a higher vibe place. I feel like that brings a lot of motivation to create positive change.
And for Claire, leading these walks has only deepened her own sense of resilience.
No matter what happens with the world, I don't ever see myself removing myself from this connection. This is life. And I would still, any day of the week, prefer to be doing this than sitting in an office with closed windows and closed doors and artificial lighting and sitting in front of a screen watching the climate burn. I would still rather be doing this. This feels more like active hope to me. Maybe it's radical, but for me, this is in a lot of ways, an act of love and reconciliation that I am committed to this work for, and that is one of the reasons why.
Climate change is reshaping our lives and our landscapes. But for those who practice forest bathing, time spent in the woods isn't about escape. It's about connection, resilience, and remembering that there's still beauty worth noticing. This has been Christina Laurie with CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative. That is all things current in Kingston for this week. Thank you for listening to CFRC's local news programming, brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. To listen on the go and hear more from some of our guests, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
What'll I Wear offers the best in vintage, funky, one-of-a-kind treasures, clothing, accessories, and a fabulous selection of jewels, vintage and new. Find the cutest purse, the most dashing of hats and sunglasses, everything to complete your individual look. What'll I Wear has it all. They can dress you from top to bottom. Find your new fashion fave at What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street in Kingston. Visit their new location and follow them on Facebook to keep up to date with what's in store at What'll I Wear.
Guys, gals, non-binary pals, different circles is moving. Same day, different time slot. We're now on Fridays at 9 p.m. Join me from 9 to 10 p.m. for an adventure through sound. Who knows? You might just find your next favorite song.
CFRC 101.9 FM is pleased to present an Airwave YGK matinee featuring live performances by Birdbone Theater, Foster Shea and Sudak, and the Oscar Evans Group. Come for an eclectic musical adventure featuring traditional Slavic sounds, folk pop, and jazz ensemble works created by local artists right here in Kingston. Join us at the Broom Factory September 28th from 1:30 to 4 p.m. for three great back-to-back performances by these wonderful local artists. Folks can come enjoy food and drink for sale in the Broom Factory's licensed cafe. Tickets are available now for $15 in advance via CFRC.ca or $20 at the door. This CFRC concert is made possible through the support of the City of Kingston, Kingston Arts Council, the Kingston Music Office, the Broom Factory, and our friends at Kingston Soundworks. Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present a selection from local jazz musician Oscar Evans' latest work, Live at Hotel Wolf Island. The album is a live recording from a quartet performance featuring Jonathan Stewart on saxophone, Nick Kornelik on piano, Andy Love on drums, and Oscar Evans on upright bass. Recorded in front of a live audience in March 2025, the album is a stellar example of Oscar's musicianship as a band leader and upright bassist. Follow Oscar on Instagram at Oscar
Mayfield Evans for upcoming releases and exciting performance announcements. Want to be highlighted next time? Complete the release radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visitkingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream live at Wolf Island by Oscar Evans on your favorite platforms and enjoy a selection from it called I Mean You with us now here on CFRC 101.9 FM.